Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. It's an exciting day for the nerds. It's the second instalment of Ordinary Apologetics. So grab yourself a cup of coffee. Don't make it Irish, it's not going to be that boring. If you're in the car, put it in cruise control. If you're on a treadmill, well done, keep going. But we're going to need your full attention for the next 30 minutes as we discuss the teleological argument, aka the argument from fine-tuning. So let's get into it, and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hi, I'm Mark Ventham.
Hello, I'm Graham Nichols.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. This is our second episode of Ordinary Apologetics. Who's excited?
Yep.
Yep.
Mark's almost excited. He's trying to be excited about it.
To be honest, guys, this is going to be a great one, but it might feel a bit like Geek Week.
It is going to feel like Geek Week, but I need you to bring it back down to Cool Week. Whenever you feel like it's getting to
me.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that because I am
That's
cool?
Your job today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You are the most ordinary person when it comes to fine tuning.
Yeah, I think there's a
least
somewhere, but I don't know where it is.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about this argument for the existence of God, which is all about fine tuning in the universe. And it's slightly more complex than the moral argument, which we covered in our first Ordinary Apologetics episode. But hopefully we're going to do a good job here and break it down in a way that means it's usable and understandable. And so that's our mission today.
It is. When I first started work, I left school quite early on and did kind of an apprenticeship. I used to work for a company that made stuff for power stations, and some of them were hydroelectric and some of them were nuclear power stations. And so we used to make the whole control room, all the panels that go in the control room and stuff like that. So I did do some visits to power stations where you'd go into a big control room, there'd be loads of screens and loads of dials and loads of things that you could set for temperatures and how high the rods that were doing the nuclear reactions and stuff were and all that kind of thing. And you could, although it would have been really scary and stupid, but you could have just gone and flicked all the dials and changed everything and made it all go hot and made it explode and made some kind of major incident that got on the news. And in a way, the fine-tuning argument's a bit like, is it possible to be the bloke in the control room and just randomly flick all these dials and to make not just a power station that works, but like a whole universe that works? Is that kind of the argument that we're going to try and talk around?
Yeah, so the fundamental idea is that I guess the problem that requires an explanation is that our universe appears to be very finely tuned, or perfectly designed, maybe is another way of saying it, for the existence of intelligent life. That's the issue that needs it cries out for an explanation from all human beings, from scientists, from Christians, from anybody. We need to explain this fine tuning.
Yeah, and it's worth saying it's a bit different to the argument from design, which is, well, we'll probably do it another week, which is more like things look like they're designed. Things look like that they've had a person been involved in creating them to make them work in a particular way. It's a kind of very special argument, not to do with design in general, but to do with particular ways that the whole physical universe works.
No, I'm not want to sound stupid, guys, but yeah. Right now this doesn't sound that complex, because we're not just simply saying things like that the Earth, the axis is on, is at a particular axis. If it was any other degree, you know, we couldn't survive. It was close to the sun. We can, you know, any closer to the sun, we'd burn up. Any further away from the sun, we'd freeze. Mm. You know, is it Sir Frederick Hoyle? He talks about the, you know, jumbo jet. You know, if you try to create a jumbo jet in a whirlwind, you know, it'd be suddenly all the parts of a jumbo jet in a whirlwind suddenly all coming together. Is this not the fine tune? As in, that sounds, I could explain that to my friend, no problem. So why is it getting complex? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, partly you're demonstrating that you are, in fact, a geek, even though you claim not to be.
I am.
And you have kind of listened to those sort of arguments. So I think for many people, They kind of vaguely might know them, but it's worth just kind of going through them. And your illustrations were fine as far as it goes, but I suppose they weren't quite so narrowed down to the particular things that are completely universal, literally, because they're right across the universe. The tilting of the axis is one thing to do with the conditions necessary for life, so it's kind of another example. It's a special example to do with the Earth, and then the aeroplane thing is more to do with the kind of argument of design. So they're really good illustrations, but we're probably going like even
a level back,
a level down to that, to saying that the components and actually the existence of the universe itself that makes all those designs possible is also looking like it was designed. So the kind of the materials to make the designs is even looking like it was designed.
Okay,
so we're going super deep. So we're subatomic,
super geek world.
We are
super geek.
There's geek. There's now we're going super geek.
Yeah, we're going subatomic. I just coined that phrase.
Geek. Yeah, we are, because the idea
Josh
is that
Bannister.
from the big, so from galaxies and stars all the way down to atoms and subatomic particles, the structure of the universe is determined by a certain group of numbers, which are called in the scientific community the constants and quantities. Okay, and those are things like the speed of light. Okay, which has a certain number attached to it, which I'm not going to say because it's super complicated.
Do you know it?
Well, I've got it written down. Okay. So no, I don't. The gravitational constant is one, okay? And other things, cosmological constant, and there's 11 of these certain constants and quantities which are required to create a universe that is life-permitting, that allows life to exist.
Yeah, it's worth saying, some people argue there's 8, some people might argue there's 6.
Okay.
I'm just reading something that says there's 6. But they all really make the same point.
So
there's enough of them.
What's 8, 6?
The number of fundamental constants in the universe. I think it depends how many you want to choose, in a way, to make the point. Really, if you get more than one, you're beginning to get into the realms of statistical improbability beyond belief. But when you get to 11, you're definitely out
there.
So
the constants, things like the theory of the speed of light, is that what you're saying? That's one constant.
It's a constant, yeah. And the point is that scientists have come to the realization that it seems like these numbers that are related to these constants and quantities have been very finely tuned to a very astonishingly precise value, and that value that they have all been tuned to is what's called the life-permitting range. And if any one of those values or constants was outside of that range, then there would be no life anywhere at all in the universe, perhaps not even any matter. No stars, nothing. So the problem is the universe appears to be very finely tuned for life. And what we have then is three competing explanations that are currently live in the kind of scientific community to explain that fine tuning. I'll give you one example, which we'll use gravity, because it's probably one of the easiest.
So gravity is one of the constants.
Yes. So let's go at it like this. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant, okay? And if that constant, if that constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, which means 10 with 60 zeros after it. So
big
if that
number.
If that your big number, if that constant was changed on a dial, you imagine those numbers on a dial. So
big
that's
goal.
10 with 60 zeros on a dial. That's how many notches you've got on this dial. Now, if that constant was changed by just 1 notch, then there would be no life. None of us would exist. Okay. And to understand how big of a number that is, how many tiny points on a dial that is, then compare it to the number of cells in your body, which is 10 to the 14th part. Okay. So that's way less. Less cells in your body.
Okay.
Or compare it to the amount of the number of seconds that have ticked down since time began, which is 10 to the 20th part, okay? And and our dial has 10 to the 60th part.
Okay, and if I move the dial by 1?
By 1.
So 10 to the 59?
Mm-hmm. If you move it by 1 increment on that dial, then life doesn't exist anywhere in the universe. And that would have happened because either the universe would have expanded too quickly, thinned out too quickly, or collapsed back in on itself if that gravitational constant wasn't where it is, okay? And that is true for all of these constants that we just talked about, whether you say there's 6 or 11, they've all been finely tuned. These dials are in exactly the right life-permitting range. And it's enormous numbers of notches on these dials. And if one of them, any one of them, was out of alignment, there's no life anywhere. There's no stars. There's no universe. There's no nothing.
Okay.
That is what we need to explain.
Yeah. And there are other things that are more sort of day-to-day in the sense that we all have heard of and use, like it or not, or know it or not, carbon and oxygen. They're like fundamental kind of components of life. And if some of those constants were different, those elements wouldn't stay together. It'd all collapse. They wouldn't bind together. So we wouldn't have all the stuff we need for making life work, for being able to make the materials of all living creatures to be able to take oxygen and burn it and make all that. So all those things wouldn't happen if any of those quantities were slightly different. So yeah. You wouldn't have any universe, so that's big scale, but you also wouldn't have lots of small stuff happening to make all the materials that would make life possible.
One of the most amazing ones, which I'll just read, is this. One of the most astonishing examples of fine-tuning is if the mass energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, then the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. I mean, that is an enormous number.
Okay, so let me just... And scientists will all agree on these things.
Yes.
So all scientists would say, yeah, there are these constants and they're all finely tuned to this measure. And if they go out of sync by just one notch, in effect, life would not exist. At grand scale, no life, no universe, but also small, we wouldn't be here. Things wouldn't be able to be made, built, etc., etc.
Precisely. Let's hear from a couple. So Sir Martin Rees, a physicist, he says, wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. Stephen Hawking, he said, the remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. That's what Stephen Hawking says.
Okay.
And one more, David Dutch, I think his name is. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features of the universe, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. These are all non-believers.
Okay, so now that fine-tuning we see, how do they explain it? Because obviously we know how we would explain it. Mm-hmm. We're going to say creator. Mm-hmm. How do they explain that? Because, you know, they've got to come up for some reason.
So there are three current live explanations, two of which will be the scientific community will probably hedge their bets on. So the first would be physical necessity, which we'll explain. The second would be chance.
Yep.
And the third will be design, which will be our explanation. But we'll go through those one at a time. Okay. So, Graham, physical, do you want to give us an idea? Yeah, physical necessity.
Physical necessity is that it's just... is like it is because that's the only way it could possibly exist. Mm-hmm. And it does exist, so it's an argument that it's not really remarkable at all. We're just observing what is rather than thinking about what could have been. We're just observing what is. So it's an argument that it's just here. It has to be this way for the Earth to exist, and the Earth exists, so what's the argument? There's nothing else to say. That would be the argument.
Yes. Now, that might sound convincing on the face of it.
I was going to say complete
opposite. Might sound unconvincing.
It totally sounds unconvincing. It sounds just like a complete no answer.
Because you believe in God.
Yeah, okay. Maybe it does. That's interesting. I think the way that we might tackle that or break that down a little bit is to say, because essentially what that argument is saying is that you've got this row of dials and and you can twist them with, you know, all these increments on them. Mm. What that argument is saying is there is no way to twist these dials. They're set. It could not have been any other way. Mm. And actually, the answer to that argument is to say, well, there's no evidence to suggest that it had to be this way. Actually, it seems infinitely more likely that those dials could have been on any one of those other numbers and we wouldn't have had any universe.
Okay, I guess what in my mind I'm thinking is, okay, how's this different to chance? Because in one sense, it just sounds like a more kind of, okay... less random version of chance.
It is linked.
It's connected, but it's more an argument to say that it's not so much that there was all these possible options and they all happened to line up in the right way by chance. It's more saying this is just what's here, and you guys, philosophers, Christians or whatever, are imposing some really complicated statistical analysis on this, and you just need to kind of get a life and just observe it and just say... it just is. Mm. It just is. You're creating this thing because you're a human being and you've got reason and logic and all that, and you're creating this whole complicated argument when actually it just is. I think that's part of the argument, to say it just is.
Someone would just go back, yeah, but how how did the is just get here?
Yeah, it's not a particularly satisfying explanation, is it?
Well, presumably, doesn't Stephen Hawking hold to things like evolution as well?
Mm-hmm.
So he would then say, this is, and then within the is, evolution then just happened, which is a chance process?
Yeah, there's an interesting saying that we sometimes would ascribe to, is sometimes ascribed to scientists, which is, give me one miracle and I'll explain the rest. So evolution explains how life develops on Earth. It doesn't have anything to say about how the universe came into existence. It doesn't ask that bigger question. So that's the question we're talking about. And I think you're right. I think it's not a particularly satisfying explanation or fine-tuning.
So what's the argument from chance?
Yeah, so it's slightly different in that it's basically just saying we got really, really, really lucky, and that, yes, the dials could have been set to any of these other increments, and yet they weren't. So what do we want to say in a response to that? Well, ultimately, we want to say that those numbers can't be reasonably faced scientifically or logically, that those numbers are so astonishingly unlikely that it is an impotent explanation. Okay, simple as that. And what then happens is, what has begun to happen in the scientific community, or has happened for a long time, is they will posit something to make those numbers more palatable. And that is called the multiverse theory. So, Graham, do you want to give us an idea about what that means?
Yeah, the multiverse theory is simply that there are loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of universes, kind of parallel universes. So, because you've got a bit of a statistical problem, there isn't enough time and space for some of these chance things to happen. Mm. If you have an infinite number of universes, there's the one we're in, but there's loads of others as well, then you could say, well, there's loads of others where it's not quite working, and there's a few where it's half working, and there's a few where one or two of the constants are right. But there's this one, which is, you know, 1 in 10 to the 60 or something of all the universes there are. And there's this one where it's working. You know, good for us. We're in the one that happens to be working.
But in the other verses, but surely that falls down because the constants aren't precise enough. So therefore, there cannot be life. So there's not growth. So what's happening in these other multiverses?
Well, potentially nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's not that I'm there.
There could be all failing. Yes. No, you're not living in all these parallel universes. Don't panic.
No.
Oh, that would have been awesome. I was suddenly going totally there in space.
What it's doing is it's trying to make that problem, that statistical problem of this is ridiculously unlikely as to make it an implausible explanation. We're saying, well, let's just increase the number of universes there are. If, like Graham said, if you posit infinite universes, then it's much more likely that these dials were correct.
More like chance that this has happened, yes, rather than just the oneness of it all.
Of the, yeah. If you've got one chance, then the chance is very low. If you've got infinite chances,
but of course, where's the proof that there are multiverses?
Well, that's exactly the right
question. Where are the others?
Exactly the right question.
Yeah, but the weird thing is, or not the weird thing really, but the fact is that this gets put forward in sort of both scientific papers, but also in sort of popular media. This does get put forward as a reasonable argument. Not always saying there's proof for it, but it definitely gets used if you read the right stuff, Mark.
Yeah, it's not what I read.
No, it's just, I know. Yeah, sorry. But even like
they haven't put it on the back of cereal boxes.
Normal daily.
On the back of Weezer, man.
But even in normal newspapers, like for ordinary people, it might just get, you know, when some new scientific discovery happens, they might kind of just throw that in as, you know, well, one of the theories is.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what? It shows how desperate the situation is, that if you need to get to this point of positing a metaphysical argument. This is not there's no evidence for this. This is purely saying, well, we need to increase the likelihood that a universe that gives life will exist. So we're going to just posit this idea about there being infinite universes. Now, there is no evidence for that. And the other massive problem with this theory is that you're just setting it back a step. So all we would say in response to that is, well, the multiverse generator, whatever's kicking out these universes,
multiverse generator.
There's a handle on, like,
whoever's cranking this generator and all these universes coming out would have to be a finely tuned system to create those universes. It can't just come out of nothing.
Yeah.
So you're just putting the problem
just
back.
It is.
You just get to it is again. Yeah. And that is not, again, a satisfying answer.
But I think what's really good, even as I sit here and listen, you think, actually, these just on one level do sound so far-fetched. Hmm. Like, it seems to me as a quite a simple being that actually they are harder to believe than the design. You know, like you have to go some to believe those kind of, and actually they don't feel very satisfactory because in the end you have to say either this is just chance, well, really, or this is, and again, what this just is, you know, it just doesn't make, and you then come back, you know, Romans 1, actually what we do in our sinfulness is suppress the truth. So much so that actually I'd prefer these kind of theories than I would the one of an acceptance of design.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where it leaves us. So those, you know, we have those two explanations. The third that's live on the board is design. And I guess what that is, what that explanation is saying that there's an intelligent being behind this universe, that it wasn't chance that these numbers were finely tuned for life, and it wasn't a necessity. They could have been different and there could have been no universe at all. Actually, no. They look finely tuned because they are. And there was a designer, there was a mind behind it that did finely tune this universe for life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really important about worldviews because the, which is another way of putting, or another way of saying that we suppress the truth, is that it's about how you interpret the data. So I think that the data is pretty clear that it's unsatisfactory to just say it is, and it's highly unlikely to say by chance it became. So those two things are true. But if your worldview is there is no God, then you've got to land on one of those two. You've either got to have the sort of the one that says, in a way, I don't care, it's just here, or the one that says, we were just very fortunate because all the dials happened to spin in the right way. And you, however unlikely it is, you've got to land on that because the other one is completely unpalatable, the idea that there was a designer, because then you've got a whole process of trying to work out who the designer is.
And what that means for me.
And what his intention is. But, I mean, the same would be true. We might talk about it in some other ones. But the same would be true of how you interpret everything. Everything that we see more coming down out of sort of planet Earth. So when you see a fossil, you interpret it in a particular way based on your worldview, God or not. When you see some evidence of design somewhere else in the animal kingdom, you interpret it in a particular way.
Okay, so ordinary apologetics is for ordinary believers. So some of this stuff will be really helpful just in terms of strengthening our own faith and confidence. But, you know, I'm sitting with my mate, Bertie. I don't have a friend called Bertie. But
it sounds more like a teddy bear.
Okay, let's go with...
John.
John. Okay, I'm meeting with my friend John in the local public house. And we're having a beer. And he's a non-believer. And we're talking about, you know, design, creation. You know, how do I get this into a conversation? You know, how do I, you know, have I got to remember the number 10 to the power of 60? Is that the number?
You have remembered it.
You did remember it.
Oh, in the house.
For one of the things, but what was it for? That would be harder to remember.
It was not gravity. Yes, it was gravity.
It was
gravity. That's the one constant. So we got the gravity constant, and there could be... Now, so I could explain it, I think. But, you know, how's that going to help them? Because how many of my mates are really engaged with the fine-tune argument? Or are you still at the level where I started with the tilt the earth, sun, moon, you know, chance thing? You say, how does this help me? How do I, you know, deal with this? Or is this kind of high-end apologetics?
You might want to say, I'll have a go, Josh, and then you
go
see.
For it.
You might want to say, so here you are sitting here with your pints, each of you. What stops these glasses and drinks are in front of you exploding into a million pieces in front of you and not being able to hold together? In fact, what stops us as we're sitting here not exploding into a million pieces and not being able to hold together in life? So that could be a good opening question. And he might say, well,
gravity.
I don't know. Or he'll say something like gravity, or, you know, the attraction of things together, or, you know, things just kind of click together. So I think most people, even though they probably don't know the numbers or the science, kind of think stuff holds together because it sticks to itself. So I think you can say something about that. You know, what makes it stick to itself? It was made like that, and it's really, really, really unlikely that stuff would stick together.
But I guess it's more the point, though, isn't it? If they say gravity, is where do you think gravity comes from?
Yeah.
So it's not that they think stick, because they'll understand gravity, but actually the question is, but where's gravity from? How do you understand?
Yeah, but they might then say, well, it just is. And you've got to say, yeah, but it's not just that it is, it's also that it's very precisely is something. And if it was a little bit different, then lots of things wouldn't attract to themselves in the same way. It wouldn't be possible for lots of things to attract to themselves.
But I think that's the point, though, isn't it? If you just say it is, you've got to then say, really, that fact that it is what? In terms of how does this work out? Did you know actually scientists would agree that actually if it was just a notch out of the Dahl idea, this wouldn't actually take place. Now you have to answer the question, is that still is? Is that the most likely explanation of how you make sense of the world around you? And in one sense, I think it's what we were talking about last time as well, isn't it? That this won't necessarily be the slam dunk answer that suddenly they're going to go, do you know what? Wow, I've never thought that. Gosh, where do I lay down my life now and follow Christ moment? But it may just be the stone in the shoe.
Absolutely.
That kind of just gets them to think, that just gets them thinking a little bit more about, hold on a second, is the is just big enough? Is this really all there is? Just gets them thinking about the world they live in and where it came from and where did they come from and what do I do next with that? And I think that's where you're trying to go with these kind of arguments. It's not about winning. You're not going to win someone into the kingdom. Well, it may do. It may be the final notch, of course, in God's sovereignty. But
Well, you're right, of course, in saying as well that this isn't an argument for the Christian God. This is just an argument for an intelligence, a kind of deity of some description, a designer.
But actually, I think one of my understandings is that lots of scientists are going much more to a designer view.
Yeah. I think in people's minds, someone like Stephen Hawking, who died a year or so ago, I think, would be like the ultimate cosmological kind of scientist. People haven't really looked in detail of what he knew and what he didn't know. They just kind of think he's got an amazing brain and so forth. So he's trying to dislodge their sort of awe of scientists who glibly, I mean, someone like Brian Cox, perhaps, who's a more at a popular level, who just kind of glibly dismiss the idea of God and sound as though they've got the answers to all these problems, when actually they haven't. They just avoid them. So they stick in areas that they know and can be really expert in areas that they know, but they're not into the big philosophy. And even Stephen Hawking wasn't into philosophy. You know, he was into detailed levels of physics, basically, and discovered lots. But when someone likes that, because of the way someone like that pronounces there is no God, generally our culture kind of sits up and listens and thinks, well, he says there's no God, so there must be no God. They don't really think, yeah, but he's not a philosopher. He's just observing stuff. Not many philosophers, a few, but not that many philosophers, argue adamantly for the non-existence of God, because it's really hard.
Yeah, that's correct. So I think to summarise that a little bit and try and bring it back together is, what's the universe looks like it's incredibly fine-tuned for life. And if you're going to have an explanation for that, it's going to be one of three things: that it was necessary, physical necessity, that it's this way, that it's chance, we just got really, really, really lucky, or that there's a designer behind it. So when you boil it down like that, it doesn't seem so complicated. And I think it's useful to open a conversation with somebody that can be done. And it's like you said, brilliant way to put a stone in the shoe, start to undermine people's potential world, non-Christian worldviews.
Yeah. And just in the few seconds we've got left, it's just worth saying that we would expect the universe to look like that, because God's said in the Bible that there's going to be evidence for his design everywhere we look, including in the fine tuning. So this
is not, heavens declare the glory of God.
Absolutely. So it's not unexpected. It's exactly what we'd expect. Not only that the earth is designed, we know that, but actually that it's going to look like it was designed.
Absolutely.
And cause us curiosity because of that.
Good job, guys, explaining something that's complex in a way that we can use it in our ordinary lives.
Well, how was that? If you have questions, send them in, ordinary@cchh.org.uk, and we'll do our best to answer them. Also, send us stories of how you've been able to use ideas from Ordinary Apologetics to start conversations with unbelievers. We'd love to read those. We're well into the summer months now, but there's still time to get a bit more reading in. So join us next week when we'll be discussing why reading is such a good idea for Christians, plus a load of recommendations from the pastor lads. We'll also be answering some of your questions. See you next week.